Welcome to The Aging Scientist, focusing on all things science and aging. I'm Clarissa Giebel, and I'm a researcher at the University of Liverpool. Season 5 is focusing on different aspects around care homes and long-term care. What people often forget is how important family members are still, even when a relative has moved into a care home. Besides the need to see your loved one in the care home, many family members remain unpaid carers and provide some form of care to their relative. The pandemic has seen a legitimate outrage at how little social contact residents were allowed for too long. So today, I'm joined by two active members from Rights for Residents, Diane and Kate, and Dr. Alice Griffith from the University of Liverpool. Diane Mayhew and her partner, Jenny Morrison, set up the Rights for Residents campaign group in August 2020. Supported by Kate and a small group of volunteers, they fought tirelessly to overturn the inhumane visiting restrictions placed on care home residents during the pandemic. Kate Meacock has cared for her mother, who has been in her home for 7 years, and to this day, restrictions are still in place. She has advanced dementia. Kate also cared for her late father. He lived independently at home until December. Alice Griffith is a lecturer in clinical psychology at the University of Liverpool. She's a mixed methods researcher whose research looks at how we can improve life for people living with dementia, particularly those living in care homes. And now that I've introduced all three of you, it's really great to have all of you on the show. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So thank you all for making the time. Really excited about this one. Starting us off, all of you have care home experiences, either personal or professional from your work. So start a question. Why do you think it is so important to focus on the families and unpaid carers of care home residents? Diane, do you want to kick us off?
Yeah, sure. I think because families provide different aspects of care to their loved ones. They have a unique personal shared history that no matter how wonderful carers are, and they are, they cannot possibly replicate knowing someone all their life. You know things about them that no one else does often. You can entertain them by knowing what music they like to listen to, help them to eat and drink, because often carers can't get them to eat and drink as they should. You know, they refuse to eat or drink. So I think it's important from that aspect as well. I think as well from the dignity point of view, because certainly from our own experience, my mother-in-law was a very proud lady and she was immaculately turned out. And, you know, she had advanced dementia. But she was really into her clothes, she was into her hair, you know, she always looked amazing. And unfortunately, when she went into the care home, unless we were in there, you know, often she'd have food down her clothes, or she didn't have the clothes on that she had somebody else's clothes on a lot of the time, but we picked up on that. You know, often she wouldn't have her teeth in, she would have been mortified if, you know, before she had the dementia, if she would have realised that people were seeing her like this. So I think dignity is also extremely important. I think the other thing is that safeguarding can be an issue, because how many times we went in and she'd have a bruise that we didn't know about, or, you know, people can develop pressure sores, or as I said before, they're not getting the right nutrition. We've also experienced she was a diabetic, and unfortunately she had to move homes because the home she was in closed down. And during that transitional period, they didn't give her a diabetic medication, and she developed all sorts of things as a result of that. So I think, you know, family pick up on things. They know when something's wrong. They can tell. They can tell when someone's upset. They can tell when someone's happy. You know, so I think it's absolutely vital that you, as Kate said before, you care for that person before they go into a care home. You don't stop caring just because others are there when you're not. You still want to be part of that care. And I think, you know, mum's face used to absolutely, pre-pandemic obviously, but a face used to light up when we went in. There's no other person that could create that. I'm sorry, but there aren't. She did really like the carers, but she wanted us in her life. We'd always been in her life, and she wanted that to continue. So I think for me, it's safeguarding, it's dignity, and it's having that unique personal shared history where you can reach that person when nobody else has that experience of their life.
Absolutely. And I remember when my great-grandparents were in a care home in Germany, and my grandma used to care for them as well. Still, she went in every day, visited them every day. And while they were in a very nice care home for that area and had lovely people around, it was wonderful seeing their daughter coming in every day, wasn't it? So.
Yeah, and I think as well, you know, often we'd be in there and you'd press the buzzer because she needed the toilet. And sometimes they didn't know you were there, and she'd be waiting and waiting and waiting, you know, and by the time they got there, it was almost too late. And so don't get me wrong, the carers in the first home she was in, they were fantastic, but they were busy. They were busy answering everybody else's buzzers and, you know, attending to other people. So I think the other thing is that family have the time where carers don't.
Absolutely. Kate, do you want to add something?
I think Di's covered most of it. But I suppose, you know, I was, when Mum was diagnosed with dementia 12 years ago, I was in the hospital room with her, and I was there. And so I know all her history. I know what makes her laugh. I know what makes her tick. I can pull her out of a bad mood. Mum's now completely immobile, has no communication at all. But I walk into the room and she'll still laugh. I only have to say a couple of things and she laughs. And that'll come into the next question, but you know, you know there's that connection that, and with the carers, I can see when she looks at the carers and they say something, the affection they have for her and she has for them is obvious.
Yeah.
But they don't have the history. So I will suddenly say, you know, I was away somewhere, I said, oh, tell Mum that I'm in X, Y, or Z. She used to come here as a child, you know, and so they were able to communicate that to her. And, you know, it's just small things. And then when my dad went into for respite care really in December, you know, he had really complex medical issues. And for them just to pick it up is impossible. And so, I mean, they literally spoke to me sort of virtually on the hour, by the hour. So, you know, what was this? What is that? He wasn't eating properly. So I was able to go in and get him to eat. And I think family is, the power of families should never be underestimated. That the carers are amazing. And they are, you know, my mum and my dad were in care for a reason. They needed more care than I could give. But it's more of medical care, and the social care side of it. But you must never remove that personal, be it a family member or a really close friend or someone, that part you should. I mean, you just can't remove it. You can't eradicate someone's history in their life and whatever. And it's just so important. It really
is. It's a human right to be with your loved one, isn't it? So
yeah, it really is. And one would always hope that you can see those people that mean the most to you.
What about you, Alice?
Yeah, I guess I come from kind of two backgrounds because obviously I do research in care homes, but I also have been a relative of someone in a care home. Two of my grandparents lived in care homes about a decade apart and had very different experiences. And certainly with my nan, because I'm 100 miles from where she was in a care home, actually they were fantastic at facilitating me having weekly phone calls with her. But I was also, I think, very aware that they knew I worked in the area. And when I went through the door, kind of ran to say hi. I was like, oh, it's her, she's back. Would you like to see the care plan? Would you like to see this? This is what she's been doing. Mm-hmm. And I guess it would have also been nice to see what that would have been like if they didn't know who I was.
Interesting. I've never heard that from anyone before. That's interesting.
I think that's
very small care home.
Just one other thing. I mean, I speak to various other people in Mum's care home who've never been at the care home when it was open properly. Mm-hmm. And they would love to be able to take their mother or father or whatever to the activities, to do the singing with them, to engage. You know, it's more, you don't just dump someone in a care home and say, right, that's it. You know, I volunteer for Singing for the Brain. I know how powerful music is. And to be able to sit with someone who can't communicate properly and to share that moment of singing and music and whatever is, it's very special. And if you know, there are, the carers are again amazing, but there isn't a one-on-one in care homes. And so to be able to sit with mum and take her into the singing side of it, you know, it's something that hopefully will come back, because it really is a special thing.
I've spoken recently to some other care home researchers and also from the Netherlands. And what strikes me is, and I fully agree with that, but having it verbalized like that was quite powerful to hear, because they said a care home is a home. Yeah. It's where you live. It's where you should feel comfortable. You have your privacy. Sure. You can socialize and you have a bit of care on top, but it's your home. And it feels like sometimes it's not regarded that way, which is a big shame.
Well, I think we saw the detrimental impact when families weren't part of the care, didn't we? Because the deteriorated so fast, many, you know, and were lonely and isolated, and just many just gave up the will to live. But sorry, Alice, I know you was talking about your experience.
I think as a researcher, one thing that I often think about is that, particularly through the pandemic, we've often focused on the residents and how the detrimental effects that they're having, but also actually for relatives, it is a huge change. It's another transition in a relationship where you've gone from identifying as a partner or a daughter to possibly identifying as a carer. And then when your loved one does go into a care home, where does that leave you? And I think
left.
That kind of, who am I? Where do I fit in this relationship now, is something that people have been talking about, and having to kind of process that anyway is incredibly hard. But then having to process that whilst not being able to see your loved one feels like it's been particularly difficult. And I think maybe we won't fully see the effects of that for a while yet, because people are now so pleased to, well, in some circumstances, be seeing their loved one that actually that might just keep them going for a while. And at some point in the near future, we might see people realizing that actually that was quite a significant trauma.
The research that we've done during the pandemic with care homes, we were only able to speak to unpaid carers, so family carers such as yourself, Kate and Diane, and care home staff as well. And I think that was interesting as well, though, to compare staff experience to family carers' experiences. But yes, absolutely, every single family carer was really badly negatively impacted on their mental health and well-being, and they had so many stories to share that I felt really uncomfortable summarizing them in, let's say, 2-3 papers or something. I would have loved to have written a case study on each of them and just shouted out about it. But what I also want to highlight as part of that study, we had an unpaid carer who was a team member, and his mother had entered a care home during the pandemic. She had really bad experiences there. He couldn't really visit her, and she sadly passed away during the pandemic as well. So I'm sure there'll be really long-term effects on the well-being of carers.
Yeah. Definitely. You know, we're hearing from members who they're having therapy because dad forgets too late for some. They've gone, you know, these restrictions have now been lifted, but the person's died and you've not seen them. And the stories that we've heard are so horrific. There's no wonder that they're having therapy. People are suffering from PTSD. You know, they can't sleep. They've got insomnia. There's all kinds of mental health issues out there as a result of this.
Absolutely horrendous what's been going on. But I suppose a little glimmer of hope is having seen your very well-advocated campaign, Rights for Residents, Diane and Kate. So it's nice to see some positive movement out there. Do you want to share a bit more about your campaign?
Yeah, sure. Kate, do you want me to start?
No, I think you go for it. Okay.
So we set up in August 2020 when, although in society restrictions had been predominantly eased, shall I say, even for vulnerable people, that wasn't the case for people in care homes, and they were still subjected to having to see their loved one through a window. And it was following one of these god-awful window visits where we had seen my mother-in-law for the first time after the lockdown. And we couldn't believe that it was the same person. She couldn't vocalize what she wanted to say anymore. She stopped smiling. It was horrific. And we came away from that visit and said, this is not right. It's not, it, this, you know, it's just not acceptable. We couldn't explain to her what a pandemic was or a virus. So we came away and I said to Jenny, look, you know, if we're feeling like this, there must be thousands of people in the same situation as us that are also feeling like this and feeling completely powerless to do anything about it. So we literally started contacting every media outlet that we knew. We wrote to people. We tried to ring people. Kate very quickly came on board and set up Twitter. That was within the 2 weeks, I think, when we first launched Rights for Residents. We came up with a name. We set up a Facebook group, which we'd never even done Facebook before. But we thought we need to bring people together to make our voices heard, because these people in care homes didn't actually have a voice at all. And at that time, not many people were talking about this. So we set up the Facebook page. Kate started the Twitter. We then started writing to the government and explaining the impact that this was having on the people that were living in care. And very quickly, we did start to get some attention. And before we knew it, we started with the Liverpool Echo. And then I went on BBC Radio Merseyside. Then we went on BBC Northwest Tonight. And it just grew beyond our expectations. We couldn't believe how many people then started coming to the Facebook group and, you know, joining and saying, I'm in this same situation and, you know, we need to do something. So, yeah, so then we wrote to the JCHR about the human rights issue because we felt that it was an abuse of human rights. We launched a petition straight away that we got many people to sign. And then we managed to get meetings. When I was writing this for this meeting, I think back now and I think how we did it, I don't know. But we got a meeting with Helen Whateley, who was the care minister at the time. We had several Zoom meetings with her. We had Zoom meetings with Liz Kendall. We had a Zoom meeting with Jeremy Hunt. We had a Zoom meeting with a guy who was part of the focus group in government called Sir David Pearson. And we just talked about what was actually happening. We told stories from our members, you know, from our own personal experience, and how important it was that at least every resident had an essential caregiver who could go in under any circumstances, because whilst COVID was a risk, so was loneliness and isolation, and there had to be a balance between the two. You know, and especially when tests became, you know, we said, why can't we be treated the same as the staff? It's that important that that person sees us, as we've said about how vital it is for the family. I then, with Kate's help, managed to contact Ruthie Henshaw, who's a West End performer, and asked her, would she become Rights Residents Ambassador? And she agreed because her mum, Gloria, was in a care home at the time and she couldn't see it at all. So Ruthie then, you know, you can imagine she got loads of TV interviews and she did lots and lots of press. And so that raised the profile as well. We devised templates for our members so that they could write to their MPs and you know, explain what was happening. And then we had, much to Kate's delight, we had a protest in Downing Street. We all had our Rights for Residents tops on. We had placards. Liz Kendall came to the protest demanding that there be a legal right for everyone to have this essential caregiver. By then, we'd got about 270,000 signatures, Kate.
Yeah, it was something like, it was, yeah, way over a quarter of a million signatures.
Yeah.
It was an incredible day.
It was absolutely fantastic. The media were there. I mean, we did that. We went down to Parliament the first time because it was when only six people could meet. Yeah. So there were just the six of us. And honestly, I've never seen it. Frightened me. ITV were there. There were cameras. It was just overwhelming, really, wasn't it, Kate?
There were about 40 of the media there, and I think we just timed it. It was just after various restrictions had lifted, and it very much caught the imagination of the media. And it was a very weird, sick day with six of us on Parliament Square.
Yeah.
I think what you are saying as well there, Diane and Kate, when you were saying, oh, well, we just started out and then it just snowballed into something huge. You really hit the nerve of thousands and hundreds of thousands of people, millions maybe, that had either these experiences or were just shocked. I mean, I'm not directly affected by it, but I was absolutely shocked that someone can't see the person they care most about. How can that be legal? That yeah. can't be. So you really hit the nerve there.
Yeah. And I think as well, there's nothing more powerful than someone telling their own story. And you know, to be honest, it has had an impact on our mental health. I think listening, not just experiencing our own situation, but some of the stories that we've heard, nobody should have
horrific.
To listen to. Yeah. They are so distressed. Honestly, just horrendous. And actually, that brings me on to, we organised an event with the help of a Labour MP called Dan Carden and Tracy Crouch, Conservative MP, who co-hosted it in Parliament on the 9th of March. And along with, because we also work with John's campaign, who are, you know, they focus on dementia and hospitals and the Relatives and Residents Association, we all invited two people who'd been directly affected by these awful restrictions. And we also invited MPs from across all parties, and many did come. And honestly, they were literally audible gasps in the audience from the stories that were heard. And I mean, just to give you a flavour, one of them, this lady, her mother had capacity and she was ringing her every day saying, I need you to come in, I need you to see me. And she couldn't go in and she passed away. And then they let her go in. And she said, I spent more time with the dead body than I couldn't see. I mean, the guilt, can you imagine the guilt that you're left with? And it's not even your guilt that you should bear. But so a lot of MPs were listening to all this and shaking their heads. Hilary Benn was there. And at one point he stood up, didn't he, Kate? And he said, "What? Who's stopping this? Who's doing this?" You know, it was because this was on the 9th of March this year. And as a result of that meeting, we've now got a cross-party letter that's been signed by, honestly, over 60 MPs, obviously the Lib Dems, Conservatives, Labour, SNPs, DUP, they've all signed it. It's going to be sent to Sajid Javid. So calling for a legal right, because although in the guidance, because the guidance changed many times, but in the guidance, it did say that every resident could nominate an essential care supporter who could go in even during outbreaks. That's still not happening. And unless there is a legal right, it never will. And it's not just in care homes, it's in hospitals as well, you know, because people, I mean, my own experience, my dad died of COVID in the first wave, and I didn't even get to say goodbye. Not my mum didn't, you know, and I can't tell you what that he didn't live in a care home, he lived at home. But when the paramedics came for him to take him in, he had capacity and he said to my mum, "Are you not coming?" And my mum just said, I can't. She never saw him again, and neither did we. And within a week, he'd gone. You know, so everybody should, even in the first wave, no matter what. Even if my mum could have gone in to be with him, to hold his hand, to comfort him, it would have been such a huge support, but there was nothing.
Yeah. I know, it's been, and I mean, you sharing these stories again now brings me back as well to how it was, and I'm sure all of us is like, because March 2020 was just out of this world, to be honest. It was completely different, but then you having that added layer of caring responsibilities and the additional stress that we all face anyways of not seeing loved ones, really hard. And I must say that having done some of the interviews for our research on intercare homes, but a lot, one of our postdocs did, Kerry Hanna, it was the most distressing study I have done in well over a decade now of dementia research. And I'm only looking at care and mental health, but this has really been, I've cried after some of these interviews and transcripts. It's not been nice. And I'm really happy that both you, Kate, Diane, and all of you at Rights for Residents are trying to make that change and campaigning for it. But Alice, do you have any experiences from your work?
Yeah, I think so. It's been yeah, quite emotional listening to Diane talk then about this. But I think it's important to highlight just how let down care homes were by the UK government and by the policy changes and the unclear guidance, and that actually, although it was very distressing for residents and relatives, also care home staff didn't want to stop people visiting and were just trying to work their way through the guidance to work out how they could allow people to come and visit and what they could do. And yeah, I know we're talking about relatives today, so that should be the focus. But I think while Diane was talking, I was just reflecting on just how difficult it was for all sides of things to try and get through those months, wasn't it? And to hear that we're still not in a position where people's relatives can go in and see them whenever they want, it is just so frustrating and upsetting to hear. In terms of the research that we were doing, I feel similarly to you, Clarissa, trying to speak to people and hearing their firsthand experiences was quite upsetting and quite distressing. And I guess came in a time when we were very much working in our own homes alone, not seeing our own families, not getting to spend time and kind of relax with other people around us. And it did feel very, very difficult to hear those stories and to take them in. And also, as you said, do them justice and share them in a way that meant that people's unique and individual stories were being shared in a way that was sensitive to their experiences, but also highlighted just how difficult things had been for them.
Sorry, it's important to recognise that staff went through absolute hell. They must have been terrified for their own health and safety, and they were all of a sudden just left to look after these people with hardly any PPE. And that is one thing I think Rights for Residents have always done. We want to bring people together, including carers and staff. We have lots of managers on our Facebook group. We have a carer managers WhatsApp group under Rights for Residents. You know, and it's so important that they aren't blamed for any of this, because it wasn't their fault, and it's still not their fault in many cases. So I think that's a really important thing that you said, Alice.
There's been absolutely no proper guidance, no proper support, it seems. And I mean, we know from before the pandemic as well, generally training is not always as easily available to care home staff, unfortunately, and support. So this has just added another layer of, well, where's the guidance, where's the support? And I feel for the staff as I feel for the families and for the residents. It's been a nightmare for everyone.
Well, very often thinking of the guidance and when it would come out, you know, it would land at 8 o'clock on a Friday night to be implemented for 8 o'clock on Monday morning or whatever. You know, and that's not fair on anyone. It's not fair on the carers. It's certainly not fair on the managers, who need to try and wade their way through language that makes no sense and then oftentimes contradicts itself. And, you know, then the families are right. You know, we've been told we can go in. No, you can't. But it says, no, but we're not, you know, we need to do risk assessments. We need to do this. We need to get that. We need to get it all in place. And it just, I think, The care homes and the social care side, I think, were just forgotten about. That, and I think maybe there was no one in that, in SAGE or whatever, that actually maybe worked in a care home, who lived in a care home or had experience of it. They were all, it was so NHS, and, you know, rightly, that it was very NHS focused, but actually you have to, it shows the importance of sorting social care out and making the two together and, you know, increasing the training, increasing the wages, increasing the, you know, getting more people into social care and making it an attractive job and a career opportunity, not just a, you become a carer and that's it, give opportunities. And, you know, just going back to restrictions, I sat in an ambulance with my dad in January and he had full capacity. And, you know, he said, well, you're coming with me, aren't you? And this was, you know, 3 months ago. And the paramedic said, I'm sorry, she's not allowed to go into the hospital with you.
Still?
Yeah, yeah. Huh. I know, up until the day before he died, I was allowed one person, 1 hour. And that was April. And it's, you know, it just doesn't make sense. I mean, I was away and I was flying back. My brother luckily went in for the 1 hour and we could have a video call. But it, you know, at no point were we offered anything other than one person by appointment for 1 hour. And that's, it's, yeah, it just, it doesn't make any sense, really, does it, anymore?
It doesn't, especially when apparently in England now the COVID doesn't exist, so we don't have to wear face masks and there's no restrictions for the public. So whereas if you go to other countries, you still see people wearing masks. And, yeah. and so you've picked up on it a little bit. And so how have the activities that Rights for Residents has done, your campaigning, have they led to actual changes in the rights of residents and their families?
I'm delighted to say that, yes, they have. Thank goodness, because the thought of these last 2 years and everything we've all done would absolutely crush me if they hadn't. But when you think back to the beginning of the pandemic, no visitors were allowed at all. Then you could have a window visit from August, I think that was, which is when we set up. See, at the beginning, when we were all in lockdown, we were all in it together, weren't we? And we all followed the rules and we thought that we were all doing the right thing. But as things started to ease, as I said, it didn't translate to care homes. So there were no garden visits. There was only window visits. There was the awful, awful pods and screens that were introduced. There was no essential caregiver. The visits were restricted once they were allowed to go in. You could only go in for like 15 minutes in many cases. They then allowed like nominated visitors only. So you had to choose within your family who went in. You had to wear full PPE at all times. And also people weren't allowed to go out either, you know, and if they did go out, they had to isolate upon their return. But I think what's important, and this is key to the issue about isolation, they weren't just isolated from us, they were isolated from each other whenever there was an outbreak. So that meant spending enormous amounts of time just in tiny rooms on their own. So in terms of, there was a series of guidance updates. So I've tried to do it in order, but they then introduced the essential caregiver so that every resident could nominate an essential caregiver who could go in under any circumstances, even including outbreaks. People could visit in the garden. Residents were then able to go out again, but again, they did have to isolate. There's now no testing required. We don't have to wear PPE anymore unless it's a mask in communal areas. This is all the supposed stuff that's supposed to be happening according to outbreak management guidance. So no PPE apart from masks in communal areas, no time restrictions, no limits on visitors. Residents are able to go out without isolating on their return, as I said. No restrictions at all, only outbreak management. And I think from our members' point of view, don't get wrong, many are getting in and they are able to do all those things, but it's not the same for everybody. And that's what we're still campaigning about. But one thing that it has done is it's created a voice for the residents and the relatives alike. And the powers that be know that we are not going to back down now and that we have to be listened to. And
you certainly created a strong momentum now, haven't you, as well?
I think so, yeah. And I think, you know, I mean, Gillian Keegan, the Care Minister, did come to our event, but unfortunately she didn't come till the last sort of 10 minutes, so she didn't get to hear the stories that had been told, and just sort of started saying, well, the guidance says this and the guidance says that, and, you know, what we were trying to say is it doesn't matter what the guidance says, it's not law and people aren't, you know, a lot of them aren't following it. And then yesterday she was called to the JCHR to give evidence about, you know, whether they did get the balance right. I don't know if you saw that, but I'll let you watch that on your own. But if you go on our Facebook page, it is there. But yeah, they're fully aware of who we are now. They all know us. I mean, even MPs are responding to our members saying that they, you know, they support the Rights for Residents campaign. I mean, this has come from me, Jenny and Kate, just three people. But what I think why it's been so powerful for us three, the urgency at the time and the desperation was so powerful that we had to do something. We couldn't not. And then to galvanise all these other people, not just in joining a group, anybody can do that, but to taking action. And, you know, we're constantly pushing them. You need to do this. You need, we've got a backbench business debate coming up at the end of May, and the care minister has got to speak in that. You know, so it's not about being reactive. It's about being proactive and about making sure that you leave no stone unturned.
Absolutely. And I think generally as unpaid carers, what I've sensed throughout the years is that unpaid carers just need to be proactive, unfortunately, don't they, to get care, even without COVID, considering that. But generally, where do you go after a diagnosis? Well, you have to often look for it yourself, don't you?
Yeah.
So I want to take us a little bit away from the pandemic, not that we're still not still in it, we are. But Alice, you've done quite a lot of work on care homes as well. So you've done work at Leeds Beckett before joining the University of Liverpool last year. So how does your work focus on the families specifically of residents, and have you found anything you were particularly surprised about perhaps?
Yeah, so I think it's impossible to do research in care homes without incorporating family members and what family members think, because I think as Diane said earlier, although staff members see the residents every day, there are things about that person that you cannot know unless you've known them for their whole life, or for your whole life dependent. Or even if you've only known them for a couple of years, there are still things that you know about them that staff don't know. And I think in terms of something that was surprising, we did some research where we looked at getting staff members, the residents and relatives to complete the same questionnaire. So they were standardised measures and we got everyone to complete the same ones about the residents' health, and looked at how well they aligned and found that they didn't align very well, which has quite significant implications in lots of different ways. So I guess implications for the way that people are cared for if the staff view is very different to that own person's view, and also their relative's view, but also the way that we do research, because a lot of the decisions about whether interventions are effective is based on these kinds of questionnaires. And actually, if we find that the way that relatives see things is very different to staff and is very different to residents, whose opinion should we be using to make the decisions about whether things are effective or not, and whether we should be funding them and whether they should be put in place in care homes? So I think that's something that was, I don't know whether I describe it as surprising, because I think we'd probably all expect there to be differences between people, but just seeing how significant those differences were was quite surprising. And thinking through what the implications for that are, and thinking about how do we get people to align, and whose view is the kind of primary view we should be taking into account when we're thinking about somebody's health or quality of life, which gave us a lot to think about and a lot to reflect on. Because
it's also important to have that evidence, isn't it? Maybe we all thought it, but now you've got the evidence and you know how strongly that actually varies. So how do we go forward with that?
Yeah, I think it was something that was definitely worth focusing on in terms of being able to demonstrate something that lots of people have talked about for a long time. And there's, particularly amongst people with dementia, there's concerns about standardised measures being used. And certainly when you collect data, particularly from people's relatives, one of the first things people often say to you is, oh, my relative doesn't fit into any of these boxes. Can I tell you about them as a human? Can I tell you about them and their story, rather than just ticking, oh, several times a week they might be upset, but every day they're smiling, that sort of thing. And it's finding that balance, isn't it, between wanting to understand people's individual stories and share them and highlight just how unique and special every person is, and being able to demonstrate on a large scale that an intervention is effective, and therefore we should be supporting residents by putting these interventions in place. And I think for a lot of relatives who haven't been involved in research before, that's quite a difficult thing to hear. So saying to someone like, oh, I'm really sorry, but the only way we can collect this data in this one study is by putting people into boxes. We're going to have to tick boxes, because actually we've got 1,000 people to tick these boxes for. And we're hoping that we can show that if we tick these boxes at the start, and if we tick these boxes at the end after we've done something in the care home, then that will encourage people to pay for it. So I think there's a lot of challenges.
I'm just imagining the data you would generate if you were to do interviews with 1,000 people, that we wouldn't, as researchers, we'd be really slow and not impacting on policy at all. So sometimes we have to do those tick boxes, don't we?
Yeah. I think 1,000 interviews would take us to retirement, Clarissa.
Yes. No, thank you. So last week in the UK, we've had Mental Health Awareness Week. And this week we are in Dementia Action Week. And there have been a lot of activities going on, Alzheimer's Society conference as well, which maybe has been one of the highlights so far as well. And if we look at maybe the mental health, Kate and Diane, you've raised this before, and Alice from your experience as well, from your work experience, it really is a huge issue that unpaid carers or family carers aren't supported. And we're doing some research at the moment as well with family and paid carers in the mental health. But all of you, what would you say are your experiences of how carers are supported once someone enters a care home? Have you had positive, negative experiences?
Very difficult to, because I'm not sure I've had any support if you're talking about a family carer. You know, it's hard enough watching someone with dementia as their journey progresses. It's a disease that, you know, you're losing someone in front of your eyes anyway. And, you know, it's often said that you lose them twice. And so to certainly over the last 2 years to have then also have lost, you know, I didn't see mum for I think it was 13 months in total. It's the mental health of for the families, for looking from the outside, looking in is I think the impact, I think, as you said earlier, it's just not going to be known for years. And the care homes, and I do understand, have been very focused on the residents and the workers. And the families are actually, if I'm brutally honest, have always been seen as the problem slightly.
Yeah.
You know, it's I'm the one that's still wearing the full PPE when I go in. I'm the one that gets escorted in and out of the building. I have to make the appointment. It's and this is today. This isn't last year or whatever. And so I'm still seen as the risk. And yet, you know, the support is there. I very much hope the support is there for the carers who have been working in impossible situations. But for families, I don't know that there is that much. Well, there certainly isn't within my care group. There isn't any support. So you know, sure, you have, and you've lost that impact by not being able to go into the care home and be in the common room, be in the sort of common lounge or be in the dining room or whatever. You know, I sit with my mum in her room and the carer brings lunch in, has two words, leaves, you know, because they're looking after all the other residents. I get that. But when you can sit in the dining room area and I can give mum lunch, you have a chat with whoever's sitting at the next door table. You talk to the carers, you talk to the activity staff who might be wandering around, you talk to the other residents. You know, you're a family. You're in someone's home and it's a communal home, but you are part of a large family. And I think certainly with mum's home, you know, she's been there 7 years, that the soul of the home is missing at the moment because you don't have that embracing feeling of being part of the family. You know, I don't know who half the staff are because you never see them. There are residents who have been and gone. I've never met, but I've heard about them. And I think I think it's very difficult. I can see it's difficult, but there should be something a mechanism in place to support the families and the mental health. You know, as I said, dementia is a hard, and not everyone in a care home obviously has dementia and is old, but for whatever reason someone is in care, the mental health of the families should be considered and very much isn't, I don't feel. I would love to be proved wrong.
What about you, Diane?
I remember this is what took me back when I was saying I was getting quite upset. When my mother-in-law first went into a care home, she was in hospital with a broken shoulder, broken hip, and a broken knee. Anyway, she was discharged from care, and we found the care home. We did our research. We went in, we checked it all out. We looked on care review, and it seemed nice enough. And we were devastated that she had to go in there, but the decision wasn't ours anymore to make because she needed 24-hour nursing care. An assessment was done in the hospital by the care home before she came out. And we went to it was pre-pandemic, so we went to the hospital and we got in the ambulance with her and went to there. And we were absolutely devastated that we'd had to reach this decision anyway. So I don't know what we were expecting, but what we got wasn't what we were expecting at all. We went in and we were shown to where her room was and then just left to settle her in, which was fine. And then the next thing, a carer just turned, no name badges on, and Jean had got dementia, so we didn't know who they were. They didn't know us. Jean obviously didn't know what the hell was going on, you know. And she said, can you just step outside while I sort your mum out, and I'm going to transfer her. And so we just assumed that was normal practice, and an assessment had been done, so she would have been fully aware of the fact that she was just recovering from all these different things all down one side. Next thing, we stood outside the door and we just heard screaming. And so we went in and she was trying to get hold of her on a bad side and lift her. And we said, no, what the hell are you doing? You know, it was awful. And after that, I said to Jenny, oh my God, what the hell, what are we going to do? We'd never met the manager. Manager never came and introduced herself to us. We didn't have any idea of what was going to happen next, where mealtimes were, nothing. And we were beside ourselves, you know, we were just, we can't leave her like this. We just can't leave her. Anyway, of course, we had to leave her. But we had our own business at the time and we went in every day. It was awful. She just looked like we'd betrayed her. Although we'd not met the manager, we met her several times after because we were constantly in her office. And eventually, we couldn't believe that there was no welcoming, nothing. No integration into what was going to happen, or nobody to greet you or ask about her, or nothing. And so the manager left, actually. It wasn't to do with us, and they got somebody else. And Jenny and I agreed that the only way that we could have peace of mind was if we got more involved in the home and we became volunteers. And so we started organising activities, not just for mum, but for everybody else in the home. We got the manager involved and we all got really close. All the other family members started joining in and it did become like a community. It was amazing. We did fundraising events. We did all kinds. But that the communication was always a problem. It always has been. It's worsened throughout the pandemic. We had a great relationship with everybody in the nursing home. But I think for a lot of people, that's the pandemic has changed all that because you're seen as the nuisance. And, you know, because you want to see your person that you love.
I think that enthusiasm that you're just sharing about what you've set up in the care home, that has then transpired to you setting up Rights for Residents, hasn't it? That passion and enthusiasm. It's lovely to see that. So I want to hear from you, Alice, as well, about did you have any experiences or from your work on the mental health support of carers?
Yeah, I think you see real differences in how much care homes welcome people into, I think, as Kate said, the family, and Diane said the community, and thinking about, are you part of that community and are you as much a member of that care home as your relative? And I think it can be really tiny things. So like, I have really vivid memories of a man who went in to have lunch with his wife every day, but actually the care home asked him to pay for his lunch every day, which was, I think it was like £1.10 or something. I remember thinking, for £5.50 a week, the impact that had on him of him feeling unwelcome and feeling that he was a visitor in his wife's home rather than being there with her, they were having lunch together. And so they were doing lots to kind of support him. And they had like their own little table in the corner and they ate together. And it was very lovely. But then he had to hand over £1.10 to someone. And it's those sorts of things that I think can have a huge impact on how welcome people feel somewhere and how integrated into the care home they feel.
Especially if one is already spending £300,000-£400,000 a month on care. That's or more pay. It could be really a lot.
Yeah. Mum's fees have gone up by 55% in 7 years.
Oh dear. So I'm realizing we're coming up to the hour here. We've talked way more than I anticipated, which is fantastic. I love getting lost in the topic. It's really lovely to hear from all of you about this. So maybe to wrap us all off, do you have any tips for families, for family carers who are in that process of transitioning to a care home, or indeed their relative is already in a care home. Any tips from anyone?
For me, it's communication. It just speak to everyone. Get meet other families. Doorstep them. I mean, there's a group of about eight of us now on a WhatsApp group, and because one person stood on the doorstep and said, "Are you getting visits? Are you getting to do whatever?" You know, it is tricky. You know, when putting someone in a care home is the hardest thing you ever have to do. And when I was looking for a home for mum, I visited about eight or nine. Mm. And why did I choose the one mum's in? It was recommended to us. The staff all smiled and said hello when I walked in. It didn't smell. Small things, but it was very obvious in some of them. So to me, it's talk to everyone, talk to other people, talk to other residents if you can. Get to meet. I'd love it, you know, to have that sort of welcome pack that when you arrive, get a contact number for two other families who you can learn what the home is about. You know, a bit like a sort of, we were talking about it yesterday, though, a parent-teacher association type thing, but within a care home, and communication. Get involved and be a part of the family and know and ask for visiting rights. Ask for the visiting policy. Biggest thing at the moment. Just make sure you know what their policies are, what their outbreak policies are. Just communication. It all comes down to communication, and it's really been lost.
Absolutely. What about you, Alice? Any tips?
I think similar to Kate, my thing would be go into the care home. And I know it's difficult at the moment, but just hang around for a bit and see what it's like. Because I think if you're asking to come to see a care home as potentially considering someone moving in there, and you're hearing you can come at 9 a.m, you can come at 9:15, we'll have 20 minutes with you. It gives you a very different feeling to a care home saying, "Oh yeah, can you drop by tomorrow? Anytime that suits you." And you really see those differences, don't you, in how welcome people feel. And also you get to see how other relatives are finding that experience. And I do appreciate that it's a very difficult time to do that at the moment, because probably no care homes are going to say, "Oh, just drop in whenever's convenient for you." But actually the way that that's communicated to you can tell you a lot about the home, I think, in terms of how welcome you're going to be at other times. And kind of if someone says, "Oh, well, we don't do evening visits," to me that kind of ringing alarm bells. Or you can come at these certain times. That's when I'd start to think, "Oh, is this the right home?" But also look online. There's lots of guidance available for care home visits. It's a kind of checklist to think about and talk about. And as Kate said, speak to people who've been through the experience, because there are lots of people who do want to speak about both the good and the bad side of things, and who can help you or might even come on the visit with you to help you spot those things that if it's your first time in a care home, you don't know what you're looking for, because you don't know what you don't know yet.
Same as buying a house, isn't it? You don't know when you've never bought a house. Always good to bring a friend who already owns one.
Particularly someone who's a builder.
Diane, anything to add to those tips?
I think I would be asking what their activity schedule is, because we don't know what's coming. We didn't expect what's gone. And if we ever end up in a situation like we were in March 2020, even if you still can have that essential care supporter, I think it's really important that they can still mix with other people and enjoy life. Mm. You know, a care home should be where you go to live the rest of your life, not where you go to die. And I think that the pandemic has turned it more, you know, it's like God's waiting room almost. You know, people are even more terrified than they were before the pandemic of having to go into a nursing home. So I'd want to know what the activity schedule was. And I think advice from me, if possible, would be just try and build a relationship with the manager, you know, and other relatives, like you said. But if you can get the manager on board, it goes a long way.
That's a very good point. I've heard that a lot from carers as well. The manager and the management is really key. Thank you all so much. I think I've learned a lot as well. And I'm sure, Alice, we as like more professionals, we can learn a lot from people such as you, Kate and Diane. So thank you, everyone. Lovely speaking to you. And if you want to find out more about Rights for Residents or Alice's work, take a look at the bio. And for more discussions into care homes, have a listen to my other podcast episode this season. Thank you.